Okay, so we are reviewing two books, the books of Yonah, but initially the book of Ruth. This is spring semester 2019. It's remarkable how that sounds. And I hope you all have a copy of the review sheet. I've literally got two copies here. So it's certainly worth having this sheet with you. And if you haven't managed to access it, please try and do so. It was sent out as a YU.edu email. And again, if you didn't get it, I've mentioned that a number of times, just email me and I will get it to you, please God, by return of email. Okay, so before we get into the subject here, I just want to say some general things. Some of you who've done my exams will know this already from before. The exam runs for 2 hours, that's pretty standard. And there are 6 questions on the paper. In this case, as I mentioned, 3 questions on the book of Ruth and 3 questions on the book of Yonah. Okay, so that kind of makes it potentially a little bit easier because you don't have so many questions on one book, but you do have 2 books to look at. At the same time, it's 5 out of 6 that you have to answer. So please make sure you don't do any heroics or whatever word you want to use and answer 6 out of 6, because what will happen is the 6th answer will just get a nice blue or red or pink line through it, depending what colour pen I'm using. Hopefully not pink. And that will be it. So I haven't got the time to juggle around looking at different answers and trying to see which one was better than the other. So 5 questions, please. That's it. The most important instruction I'm going to give you today is one that I've said already, that each question has a number of parts, right? So you'll have question 1, part A, part B, part C, and sometimes even part D. So please make sure that you answer every part of every question. If you want to answer it as one whole question, if you think that's the way you should answer it, that's no problem, provided that you make it absolutely clear as you go through the question, like put it in the margin or whatever, that this is answering, you know, part B, C, or D. Really up to you as to the way you want to answer the question. The little blue books or pink books or white books or whatever books they're going to have to give you this time, please don't hesitate to use as many as you need. Okay? This is kind of important. Just tell me who you've just come in. Yeah, Tara. You were here already. The books that you're given, please do not write anywhere on the covers, right? Some of you heard them before. The young lady who now, probably as I've guessed, probably now by now is married with children, I suspect, a number of years ago, wrote an answer on the back cover, starting on the back inside cover, not talking about the white page, but the blue page, the cover page, and finished it on the outside back cover with about a millimeter to go. Remarkable piece of work, but it did not endear her to me for the reasons that I've just mentioned. Don't write on the covers. The only thing you write on the cover is the front cover, your name, and if you're going to use more than one book, just make sure you pop, pretty obvious, put number 1, number 2, etc., how many books you use. Even it will only require one more word, and you don't have room for it, and on book 1, take another booklet. Don't hesitate. Alright, these booklets are here, they seem to multiply, they have a life of their own, and I have no issues with, you know, using as many booklets for you to use as many booklets as you need. Don't feel that conservation is the name of the game in this case. In terms of the order of the questions, they can be answered in any order, right? I don't require 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can do number 5, 3, 2, whatever. And as I said, please make sure every part of every question is answered. I can't give you 20 points when it's 4 parts of a question. You only answered 3 parts of that question. The max you'll get is 15 points. That's just the way it works. So it's kind of obvious, but unfortunately every year somebody sort of messes up on that. And for goodness sake, answer 5 questions. Don't leave the room. You know, you say, you look at the clock, it's 1 hour and a quarter, and you sort of say to yourself, well, I'm sort of done. But you haven't answered the 5th question, that will really put down your chances of getting a decent grade. Again, that happens usually one or two students every time. If you have extra time and you've given me the paper or whatever, that obviously will work out on the day. There is a proctoring, I think, downstairs. 619 is usually the room. But we'll see. As I said, that will go on a needs basis at the time of the exam. Do not make arrangements after the exam to be somewhere. Let's say your exam finishes from it's 1 till 3. So the example I always give, again, is a young lady who's probably now also probably a grandmother by now. This is a very long time ago, but she decided to fly to Israel 2 hours after my exam. So she finished the exam at 3, and her flight literally was taking off at 5 o'clock from JFK. Now, again, if she had been someone belonging to the Star Trek organization, I would have said, great, press your button, beam to JFK, and you would have been there in 30 seconds. It doesn't work like that. You've got to get in a cab, you've got to get there. She really compromised her exam. It was a bit sad, but nothing I could do about it. So instead of taking 2 hours, she took literally 20 minutes, ran out of the room, and ended up with a C grade instead of an A. It's one of those things just to be sensible. I say this because, again, people sometimes come out with all strange requests nearer the exam. I've got this, I've got that. And, you know, just look at the exam and the timing after the exam, particularly your exams which are towards the end of your exam period. In terms of pen, I always mention this because it's important. Okay, blue pen, black pen, pencil if necessary, although I prefer you to write in pen. Please do not use any of these wild colors that you might be tempted to use. I talk about a young lady who wrote something in bright pink, her whole paper. Okay, well, I had one last semester which was in faint pencil. It was almost impossible to read. And it's a problem. Okay, if you're going to use a pencil, make sure it's legible. The bright pink one, I couldn't even read in the sunlight. I had to actually read it in the dark with a light, you know, like a beam on it. Quite amazing. But that, thank God, has never been repeated, and please do not repeat it, right? Black, blue, or pencil, but make sure I can read it. Again, neatness, being organized when you give in the paper, that's very, very important. I understand everyone's writing is different, but try your best to make it as presentable as possible. Okay, should you write on both sides of the page, it's really up to you. They're pretty thin pages. I really don't mind if you write one side of the page and then flip it over and go to the next full page. You see what I mean? You know, don't write both sides. Please leave the margins if you can, because that gives me a chance to do what I have to do. All these are very simple instructions. The important instruction is about the books. When you come into the exam, you will be allowed to bring in a simple Hebrew English text. So for instance, if you have a Koran Bible, or if you have a JPS, Hebrew English, or even Art Scroll, Tanakh, that green book, right, the heavy green book, that's quite acceptable to be used. It'll cover both exams quite nicely. But what I'm not able to allow in the exam is anything with an explanation like the book that we used. The Judaic is not acceptable, neither is the Art Scroll with commentary, anything like that. So again, simple Hebrew English text. Hebrew only, I'm just going to mention this and I'll take your question, Hebrew only is acceptable. So if you want to bring in Mikrot Gedolot, that would be fine. Okay, Hebrew only. But again, for majority, Hebrew English is fine, but not more than that. Okay, Miriam, yeah. Sorry?
Well, they usually
you'll find them around the building. I mean, it's not very hard to get hold of, but if you need to order it, Koren. Koren Tanah. Koren. If you go onto their website, it's very, very easy. And it's a good book to have in your collection. I mean, it's not a book that you'll regret buying, I assure you, if you need to buy it. excuse me. If you want to highlight any passages or any psukim, because one of the things I do like is for people to refer to text. Okay, you know, when you talk about discussion with Ruth and or discussion with Yonah, it'll be nice that you refer to them specifically by not whole chunks of text. I don't expect anyone to start, you know, quoting sort of whatever, but occasional phrase, if you can put it into your answer, You know, for instance, when you refer to the Kikayon, that's that story that we're going to talk about in a minute, surely that's something that would be nice if you actually sort of, quoted a bit more of the Pasuk in any specific answer. So I think that's important. But again, this is very much down to you, but the limit is Hebrew English text. Okay, we'll make that absolutely clear. So, yes, Brenda.
Can you print out the Hebrew English Sfaria?
Yeah, you can print out Sfaria. A number of students have done that already in other exams. Perfectly good. Okay, that's a wonderful... If you've just come out of this class knowing about Sfaria for the first time, you've already gained something, because this is something that's going to be with you for your whole life. It's a phenomenal resource, absolutely phenomenal, to the point where they've just got hold of Nechama Leibowitz's, who I've mentioned a number of times, one of my teachers in Israel, who really is very well known, probably the most famous Bible teacher in Israel. Her Dapin, she wrote a lot of questions on different parshiot, be it on Torah or Nach. And these question papers go back to 1940s, really that old. And they put them now on Sfaria. What they didn't do, which we're all trying to do from time to time, is to find out the answers that Nechama really wanted. She never wrote down the answer. She always relied on the students to provide her with the answers. And that was part of the fun of being in her class. So again, Sfaria, no problem whatsoever. Yeah. When is this final? Somebody please tell me. 21st. I know. Yeah, they're all in the afternoon. This is M for mother, or M for whatever. M for McDonald's, I was going to say, but I shouldn't say that. M for mother. And again, be on time, etc., etc. All the usual rules apply. Okay? All right, trying to think of anything else. Yes?
Yeah, because then when we go through the questions, could you just tell us which?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you chapters. Sukkim is more complicated, but chapters for sure. Any other questions? Any other things that I should be mentioning? I don't expect... That's a good point, which I do mention always. If you want to tell me this is the opinion of Rashi or Barbanel or whatever, that's perfectly acceptable, but I have no expectation of that. Okay? What I'm expecting is the actual idea, the actual concept, but not necessarily who said it. That's to me, that's the difference between undergraduate and graduate Jewish studies. Graduate Jewish studies, I expect you to be quoting people all over the place, and that's a different concept. But at undergrad, as long as you know the idea, that is really the most important thing that you need to know. Obviously, what I would say to you initially in your preparation is just to read through the text. These are short books, so they won't take you very long to go through the text again. And then, once you've done that, you'll be able to sort of have clear in your mind what's going on, and then you can attack the various insights that we are examining today. Any other comments? Good. All right. So, without further ado, let's go to the review sheet. If you can help me out here a little bit, I'd be very happy. Some of you can suggest what you would write for this particular answer. So, number one. The historical setting of the Book of Ruth. In other words, when did the Book of Ruth historically take place? Okay, any suggestions, any comments? During which period? There are various periods in Jewish history. It's obviously not in the desert. It's not before they came to Eretz Israel. All right, so which period do we normally associate the Book of Ruth with? The period of? Called in Hebrew or English? Shoftim. Good. It's the period of Shoftim. I think I mentioned to you that in the non-Jewish Bible, which is kind of interesting, they actually don't do it the way we do. We put the Megillot in the order of the way they are read during the year, starting off with Shir HaShirim, then Rut, and then Eicha, if you look in the Hebrew Bible. But if you look in the non-Hebrew, meaning the Christian Bible, they actually have the Book of Ruth immediately after the Book of Judges, which historically makes a lot of sense. Okay, we don't do it like that because obviously our Tanakh is based on other considerations, like when we actually read these books in Shul. So the historical setting of the Book of Ruth is the period of Shoftim. Okay, do you remember which judge or around which chapter, maybe I don't know if we explain this, which chapter in the Book of Shoftim relates to the Book of Ruth? I'll give you the number because I don't think I actually mentioned this. It's around chapter 12. Okay, so it's after Yiftah, and there is a judge over there who is mentioned by the name of Ibtzan. IVTZAN or Aleph Yud Bet Tzadi Nun, something like that. Iv Tzad with a bet. And that judge is traditionally aligned to be the same person as Boaz. Right? And we're told over there not very much about him, except he had many, many children. And it links into the story of Ruth. You remember when Boaz and Ruth finally get married, it says that was after Boaz had already lost all of his previous children. So if you look how many children, I think it says like 30 or 40 children, some enormous number, one assumes from a various number of wives. I sincerely hope it's not from one wife, otherwise the poor lady will be not in good shape. Reality is that the book of Ruth does fit in more or less into the middle of the book of Judges, and I think that that's probably more than we need to say about the historical setting, except to understand that the book of Ruth, as I've always suggested when I've taught it over a number of different places, and these shiurim are also online if you want to listen to them to help you review. There are a number of shiurim online, YU Torah. The book of Ruth, I've always argued, is the refuah to the makkah. The refuah to the makkah means that the makkah of the historical setting is that in the book of Shoftim, there is one major behavior pattern which is missing throughout the period of Judges. And it says so at the end of chapter 8 of the book of Shoftim. If you look at the end of chapter 8 of the book of Shoftim, it says there that v'lo osu chesed im Gidon. They did not do a kindness with Gidon. And of course, that opens up a whole discussion. What was missing, essentially, during the period of Judges is the sense of chesed. Chesed meaning kindness between each other. Bigger picture, between tribes. There was too much tribal rivalry. Okay, and eventually civil war breaks out between, remember, the end of the book of Judges, between the tribe of Binyamin and everybody else over the Pelegish Begivah. The whole time period, 360 years of the book of Judges, very, very difficult stories which lack any sense of chesed, kindness one to the other. Along comes the book of Ruth, written later by the Novi Shmuel, Samuel the prophet, and he realizes that he needs at his particular moment in history to record this as a testimony forever and ever. If Israel, as a society, lacks midat ha-chesed, then it just does not function. Right? I just saw at the weekend a very wonderful piece on, it's called ILTV in Israel Today, an organization called Dor Lador. Really something quite spectacular. And this organization, Dor Lador, is again not a religious organization, it covers goes right across the spectrum, is a WhatsApp group essentially, but it's very big, of people who are volunteering to help people who are elderly, who need company. They literally coordinate from different towns, different places, right across the country. And it's a fabulous thing. If you're on the way home and you know there's an older person who needs a visit or needs help with their laundry or whatever it may be, you go onto WhatsApp, you put the address or who needs it, and somebody volunteers immediately to go. All right, this is the way Israel functions today, and I'm sure that these acts of chesed don't go without notice, certainly in the heavenly world. You know, the fact is that Israel is a marvel when it comes to acts of chesed. Organization today is really quite amazing. So again, the setting of the book of Ruth, the issues of chesed, the pasuk that you can all quote, which will make me very happy, Olam, Olam, chesed yibaneh. Okay, it's actually a quote, I think, from the book of Mishlei. Olam, the world, chesed in kindness, yibaneh, will be built. The world is built through kindness, through chesed. So this is very significant, and of course in the book of Ruth, many, many examples of chesed, I think, are even, I don't have it on here, but obviously Ruth's relationship with her mother-in-law, with Naomi, the way that Ruth refuses to leave her alone, to leave her behind, as it were, to go back to Israel on her own. Ruth comes, Ruth is there, she goes looking for the food, chapter 2. Okay, check out that whole story, which is so beautiful. And even in the end, with the whole thing with Boaz, when her mother-in-law tells her to go, And Ruth understands, mitam tzniut, that this is breaching the laws of tzniut. She's going to be with Boaz in the goren, in the threshing floor overnight. But her mother-in-law says, "This if this is now where you've got to push the envelope, got to push the agenda, because I know that if we don't do it, Boaz will not be moved to do what he has to do, geula. We'll talk about that in a minute. So the bottom line of what happens in this book of Ruth is, from start to finish, acts of chesed. Okay, so I want to make that absolutely clear. Any questions? Because that is a very full answer on number one. Okay, and obviously you'll give the examples accordingly. Again, it really comes from the whole book. It's really right throughout the book. All right, if no questions, we'll go on to number two. The dramatic interpretation of Rav Rabinovitz as to why Elimelech left Eretz Yisrael. Okay, yes. Correct. That is the traditional interpretation brought by Rashi. Rashi says, why did Elimelech go? Because he was, in fact, very wealthy. And if you remember, what he really did not want to do is to become the, you know, the sort of the single welfare organization in the country. And as a result, he picked up and ran away. And he ran to Moab, which was a society which was quite the opposite. Right? A society which was totally built on no chesed whatsoever. How do we know that? Because when the Jews are traveling through the desert, Moab did not greet the Jewish people in any way, did not help them, did not offer them even a glass of water. Alright, this is clearly unacceptable. What Rav Rabinovitz says, and this goes right back to the beginning of the semester, and I really ask you to review your notes on that, is that he was writing, and I explained to you, this is a Rav, completely unique interpretation of someone who lived through the end of the 19th century. This rabbi, Rabinovitz, who came from Poland, was a very well-educated gentleman, and he knew about world history, what was going on in the world around. Some of the rabbis in those days did. Most of the rabbis, I can argue, you can see just the way they wrote, they really did not know what was going on, even in the city next door. But this rabbi did. And he writes a lot about revolution. And again, if you know your 1800s, 1848, the year of the revolutions, obviously the French Revolution just before the 1800s begin, 1797 or whatever it was, and you've got the Russian Revolution coming up in 1917, it's a very unstable time, and Rabbi Rabinovitz writes about that. And he says that, in fact, the Book of Ruth really reflects a similar situation in the biblical world. And he says that one thing about Elimelech, which I think is so fascinating and so different, right? Again, Rashi says he ran away because he was stingy. Rabbi Rabinovitz says no. He says that might have been part of the reason, but he says there's a much more fundamental reason. Elimelech, his name, Eli Melech. Okay, that's going to be the key to remembering this whole interpretation. Eli, to me, Melech, is due the kingship. Right? Eli Malchut, that I deserve to be the king. Elimelech was absolutely non-accepting of the fact that he did not become appointed as a shofet. Okay, and in fact, turns out that I think that was the appointment at the time of Ifsan. Ifsan was made the shofet and Elimelech wasn't. So Elimelech decides that this is not acceptable. And in order to change the status quo, he's got to make what the rabbi talks about in his world, which we know from history, he's got to make a revolution. Now, how do you make a revolution? By building an army, getting people together to fight against the leadership. And this is what he says happened with Elimelech. Elimelech goes out of Eretz Israel in order to raise an army. Fascinating. Such a different interpretation. Again, it makes sense because you need money to buy, you know, this essentially will be mercenaries, and he needs money to pay for that. And he's a wealthy man. So from the point of view of wealth, he certainly is in a position to be able to do this. He goes out of Eretz Israel, and he goes to Moab. Now again, Moab is not by chance. Moab today is around the area of Jordan. And he goes there, and he develops a bond, a relationship with them, obviously, I guess he had to bribe whoever he needed to bribe. You know, this is the way it works. And he decides that he is going to raise an army, and he's going to come back and take over the leadership of Israel by force. Fascinating. So this is what Rabbi Rabinowitz says. He ran away from Eretz Israel in order to do that. Now, obviously, a bit dramatic in terms of interpretation, because very different to anything that, certainly anything that I've ever found on the Megillah, which is why I shared it with you. And more to the point, you know, it does make the whole story into sort of a much bigger story. Okay, because what happens is, Elimelech, obviously, the beginning of the book covers 10 years. So during those 10 years, he tries to raise an army, and in the end, it says quite clearly he dies. So he's not around to do it. So who takes over the enterprise? His sons. Two sons, Machlon and Kilion. Okay, and Machlon and Kilion, this really runs into question number 3, where the question is asked, did they marry out? Because what happened was, if Elimelech was not now around to bring the army back to Israel, with the attempted coup that he wanted to make against the leadership, the shofet of the day, then the children, Machlon and Kilion, decided, or I don't remember now how he puts it, but they took over their father's dream, their father's preparation. So they were also in Moab. And according to Rabbi Rabinowitz, this explains perfectly why they married Rut and Orpah. Who were Rut and Orpah in Moab? What was their status? Anybody remember? This is important. Brenda. Sorry?
Were they like royalty?
Exactly. They were royalty. Good. They were royalty. They were princesses. And in order to endear yourself to the royal family, right, you marry your children off to each other, as later on we see with Shlomo, exactly what Shlomo did. He married every princess in the non-Jewish world, converted them somehow to becoming Jewish, seemingly not a very sincere conversion, because they all become idolatrous at the end. And as a consequence of marrying the princesses, you are guaranteed, you know, some sort of introduction or intro into Moabite society. But of course, this was not going to happen, because Machlon and Kilion, as we know, also die. Okay, and please look up again. I think we even spoke about their names a little bit, because their names are different. If you look in Divrei Yamim, their names are written differently there. I don't remember now the names. I think one is called Saraf. I'm not remember now which one, what names they had. When he talks about this particular story in Divrei Yamim, but why they're called Machlon and Kilion, because this was leading them to the path of, literally, Kilion means destruction. Machlon, Machala, disease, Kilion, destruction. So of course, this plan, which was to go and take over Eretz Israel, was a total disaster. And after 10 years, Naomi is left essentially with her two daughters-in-law, with Ruth, and with Orpah. The husbands are dead, both Elimelech, the husband of Ruth, and Machlon and Kilion, the husbands of Ruth and Orpah. One thing I just want to mention here, so that's really essentially, just go back a minute, dramatic interpretation, it really is dramatic interpretation of what was going on with Machlon and Kilion. And just to add, what Rabbi Rabinowitz points out, is that Shmuel HaNavi, when he writes the book, and remember, he's living about 100 years after these events, he is writing it as a warning, as a testimonial, but more as a warning to King Saul. King Saul is absolutely determined to continue as king, even after he fails with the story of Amalek. That's Shmuel Aleph, chapter 15. Shaul is absolutely determined, even though he's told that he's not going to continue as being the king. So what happened was that in order to facilitate this particular desire of King Saul, he spends a lot of time trying to kill David. Okay, he knows his initial relationship with David is very strongly positive, but then it becomes very negative. If you want to see more of that, you look at the Haftarah we read last Shabbat, and that's chapter... 20, I think, of Shmuel Aleph, and it tells you the whole thing, that the king even started throwing spears at his own son, Yonatan, who was friendly with David. Shmuel HaNavi is writing the book of Ruth, And he is writing a story for Shaul to become aware. Shaul, when you are trying to do this sort of stuff and to go against the natural order of kingship, etc., etc., look at what happened to Elimelech. Elimelech tried to usurp the throne, as Shakespeare would have put it. He tried to become the king, and he was rebuffed. Essentially, the whole plan failed. So Shaul, for goodness sake, don't pursue David to the point in which he was pursuing him. It was a message to Shaul to say to him, enough is enough. And Shaul eventually stops pursuing David. And maybe one can suggest that Shaul was finally convinced for a lot of reasons, but one of them might have been learning the lesson of the book of Ruth. He would have seen what happened to Elimelech, did not succeed, and Shaul may have said to himself, I get it. I finally get it, what Shmuel is trying to tell me. Rabbi Rabinowitz, please look in your notes. He does actually give four reasons why the book of Ruth was written. Right, one was to teach Shaul about kingship. I think the other one, if not mistaken, not one of the other ones, is about a guy called Doeg. And Doeg was a gentleman who appears in Shmuel Aleph and does doubt whether David was even Jewish. And therefore, obviously, and in fact, what Doeg wants to do essentially is to get rid of David completely. He seems to be very, very determined to do that, and as a consequence he wants to go back not even to a system of kingship, but he would go back to a system of judges as existed before. Just want to finish my thought. And again, the book of Ruth is warning Doeg, you're saying David is not Jewish, you are wrong, right? By the end of the book of Ruth, we know that Ruth's ancestry is both her conversion is confirmed, that she became Jewish, and that it was allowed. Remember, the whole discussion was based on a law of the oral law. The Torah says, don't marry a Moabite. So what does the rabbi say? Moabite means a male, but not a female. You can marry a female Moabite. And Ruth was obviously a female Moabite. So this law, which was an oral tradition, was not written down in the Torah, but it was learned from what we call in Gemara terms, diuk. It was deduced from the Torah. This was something which Doeg wanted to question, and the book of Ruth establishes David's lineage forever and ever. Okay? There's also, obviously, other reasons why the book of Ruth was written. I can't remember now. There was a third reason which slips my mind, but at the time we did talk about it. Please look at your notes on the introduction to the book of Ruth, why the book was written. There are about three or four reasons which come out almost each chapter. Each chapter answers one of the reasons as to why, or explains one of the reasons as to why the book was written. Okay, yes. Celia.
Didn't we say that this is the exact reason why the book of Ruth was part of the 24 books of Gilman?
Because
of the fact to show that she's actually Jewish
and that's part of it. That's essentially what I'm talking about now, and that's really absolutely correct. That's why it was included. That's why it's such an important book. It teaches us not only morality, lessons in morality, but also essentially historical development of the royal family. Okay, just to mention the wonderful Mazel Tov in England, that the young baby was born yesterday. A son was delivered. That's what the expression is at Buckingham Palace. Don't ask me what that means. Why can't they say he was born? I really do not know. But that's a very English thing. I can't explain it. And he immediately, the question was, what is he in terms of kingship? And it turns out this baby is now seventh in line. Okay? Which is not exactly far away from being king, but it probably won't happen, unless something terrible happens to the whole family. It's very interesting. So again, matters of kingship are issues which do not go away ever, right, from discussion either in the ancient world or, as we're saying now, in the modern world as well. Very interesting thing. One more thing I want to say about the sons of Elimelech. Did they marry out? There is a very big argument about that. Does anyone remember who says that they did not marry out? Who is the one opinion that is adamant that they did not marry out. Again, I'm not looking for names, but if you remember who said it, that would be very good. Okay, a lot of rabbis. Think of all the famous rabbis that you know the name. Right? Yes. Excellent. Ibn Ezra. He is the one who says categorically, if you look at the Ibn Ezra at the beginning, I think on verse 5, chapter 1, verse 5, he says quite categorically, it's impossible to conceive of the sons of Elimelech not converting these women before they married them. However, I looked at many other opinions, we saw a whole bunch of different suggestions, and nobody agrees with the Ibn Ezra. It's amazing. Almost everyone, starting with Rashi and going all the way along through what we call the Rishonim, all the early opinions all say the same thing, that part of the sin of the two sons was that they did marry out. And of course, according to Rabbi Rabinowitz, it has to be that they married out for the simple reason that that was part of the plan. If they had converted these women to be Jewish in Moab, that would have completely been self-defeating in their plan to take an army and conquer Israel. The Moabites would have said, what are you doing? You're converting these people to become Jewish. Get out of here. They would never have supported them. So it's clear from the majority of opinions that the sons of Elimelech did marry out. No question. Now, does that mean that there was no conversion later on? Of course not. With Ruth, there was. Okay, but her conversion, her commitment to Judaism comes when she's on the way back to Eretz Israel with her mother-in-law, not when she got married. So I want to make that clear. One opinion says that they didn't marry out Ibn Ezra. Everybody else says absolutely clear that that was part of their sin. Essentially, that's why they died. Right? It says that that was a punishment. The early death that they was visiting on them was a punishment for their particular act of intermarriage. Any questions? I want to move on. Okay, look at number 4. Ruth's act of conversion, the place of chesed in the story, we've spoken about that. And the whole question of the conversion, have a look at your notes, because we did point out something very beautiful, I think, for Rabbi Bachra, that the four expressions, your people are my people, your God is my God, where you go, I go, and where you will die, is not just a very nice thing to say, but it was an actual commitment to observance of halakha. Again, should be listening quite carefully to this. Those people playing on their phones at the back, very not good thing to do. She's not even listening. Very sad. The reason why is because, you know, you're getting guidelines for the exam. If you're interested in doing well on this exam, I suggest that you listen. It really is important. Yes?
Do you know around what
parents were expressing? Yeah, the four expressions are the... It's also chapter 1, round about verses 16, 17, something like that. You'll see it there quite clearly. So her act of conversion eventually is very sincere. Remember, Orpah goes back. Orpah, the name Orpah means Orev. Turn the back of your neck. Interesting name. And again, symbolic, because she turned her back on her mother-in-law and on being Jewish. Okay, she went back to Eretz Moab. And we know that eventually Orpah became the mother of, or grandmother possibly of, which famous person in the Bible, because we know all about him. David had a battle with
Goliath,
right? So it's interesting that the two sisters are essentially reunited, but obviously not in a pleasant way, later on when David and Goliath meet on the battlefield. All right, David representing descendant of Ruth, and Goliath representing the descendant of Orpah. She had, in fact, four sons. It says that she went back and she was terribly abused. She was raped and all the rest of it. It's a whole description of the rabbis. And Orpah kind of disappears into history, except for the story of Goliath. Okay, so that's Ruth's act of conversion. And again, as I said, please check your notes on that, particularly the end of chapter 1. The issue of David's yichus, the famous statement of the Gemara. Right, that again, back to the whole thing of Moavi velo Moavit. This was a law that was enacted initially by Boaz. Boaz brought that particular law into existence with his Sanhedrin. Boaz was, in the story of Ruth, a man who was already, according to Chazal, he was 80 years old. So this is not a youngster. He was head of the Sanhedrin of his day, especially if we say Ibsan, the same guy, the judge, by definition, would be the head of the Sanhedrin. And a rule was enacted to allow female Moabites to become Jewish. Right? And of course, people would say, well, with later on in history, they would say, well, you know why Boaz did it? Because he had, as it were, he was madly passionate for Ruth. It's not true. Okay, when you look at the story, it's very clear that Boaz was not prepared without some encouragement to even consider marrying her. Particularly, he's 80 years old, she's much younger. And according to Chazal, and it's not mentioned in the story, they literally were married, and the next day he died. She conceived a child from him, and that was it. He died. His purpose was fulfilled. So it's a very unbelievable, a very amazing set of circumstances that happened with Ruth and Boaz. The question of David's Yichus is really very, very significant, because later on, and we mentioned this, Doeg, who in the time of David doubted that David was Jewish. He said, how can we have a king, David, when in fact his great-grandmother Ruth, who was still alive, by the way, interesting thing, she lived right through to the days of Shlomo, Ruth was not Jewish, he claimed. Because the whole thing of Moabite men and not Moabite women, he doubted the tradition. So what happened was that they went to the Beit Midrash, they had a tremendous argument about it, and it says Amasa ben Yeter, one of the leaders of the army, in fact I think it was the head of the army at a certain time, David's army, he comes into the Beit Midrash, quizzes the whole Gemara, right, which you've got in your notes, I'm sure I've mentioned a number of times, and he took a sword and he put it in the ground, and he said, whoever does not accept that this interpretation, males yet, not female yet, in the case of Moab, should have to deal with my sword. He was absolutely convinced that this halakha was established, and he established it essentially again, almost by force. This is something which Shmuel wants to make public, he wants to make it known, and that's part of the reason why he wrote the book of Ruth. Okay, so that again is really important. And you look at chapter 4, I'll take your question in a second, at the end of chapter 4, it ends the story, and then it says who David is in relation to Ruth. It goes through, this one had this one, this man had this, gave birth to this particular child, etc. This is the son of, and you go from Ruth right down to the time of David and beyond, which again is part of the whole story, the Mashiach. Why is David's Yichus, this is part 2, thank you for reminding me of the whole discussion of the Yichus of David, is because David becomes clearly the king who will focus for us the messianic line. It will go through David. It starts right back with Yehuda and the story of Yehuda and Tamar, that's Bereishit chapter 38. And it goes all the way through history with some very dubious situations, right? Obviously, thinking about the birth of Moab itself. Moab comes from an incestuous relationship. Tamar and Yehuda are also very difficult story there. She dresses up as a zonah, prostitute. Whole story there, which is again very strange. And we did speak about that Mashiach seems to have to come from a very murky beginning. Murky in the sense, it's not clear, it's not something which is pristine. And part of the explanation is because we try to avoid, I suppose the expression we use, Ayin Hara, Satan, whatever, some negative force to come in and stop the process. So if we keep it looking as if it's all happening in sin, when it really isn't, then the reality is that whole discussion falls away, and the messianic process is continued through David, and obviously beyond, and we're still waiting. Mashiach ben David is something we daven for almost every single day, three times a day, et Tzemach David, Meheru Tatzmiya, and on Shabbat, etc. Yeah. Sorry, again, Amasa ben Yeter. He put a sword in the ground. It's a whole thing. You've got the hand up with that particular thing on it in English. And he said, whoever contradicts this law that the female Moabite can become Jewish, whoever goes against that, will be subject to punishment with my sword. Basically, I'm going to kill you. That's pretty dramatic. The Beth Din doesn't do it like that today. Thank God. So again, all of this whole thing, and again, Rabbi Rabinowitz mentions in his introduction, that's another reason why the Book of Ruth was written, to make sure that David's Yichus, for messianic reasons, was established, confirmed, and will always be without anybody coming along and saying, well, you know what, he really wasn't Jewish. Which is, what, believe it or not, what they were saying when David was alive. Jews are very difficult to please. Yes, question. Amasa ben Yeter. Amasa, if you don't remember his full name, Amasa, A-M-A-S-A. And he was the head of the army. And usually the head of the army was also the head of the Sanhedrin. Kind of an interesting combination of jobs. Okay, being the head of the religious body and the head of the military. I guess in order to make the law serious, you had to have a, what you call in Yiddish a shtarker. You had to have someone really strong to run the whole religious courts. Interesting thought. I'm not going to go there. Number six, the act of Geula is described in the book of Ruth. This is really, well, this is chapter 4. Okay, and this is something which we mention is not common or something that we practice today. The act of Geula, redemption. And again, just to explain very briefly, what happens is, or what used to happen, there is a law in the Torah of redeeming land. Right, land that belongs to a certain person which is inherited, and you have to sell it for whatever reason. You have a certain period of time, you can buy it back. Now that land seemingly, that law seemingly was applicable here as well, because the land of, Elimelech had to be redeemed. But what would make it more complicated is that to redeem the land of Elimelech, you had to also take on the marriage of Ruth. Right, she was part of the deal. And that's the Geula that is referred to here. And there's somebody called Ploni Almoni. Remember, there are a number of brothers. I think you all wrote down the relationship between all the different brothers with Ruth and Boaz, etc. And it turns out that this other brother who was still alive was asked, do you want to carry out the act of Geula, redemption? Something which we actually don't practice today. And the answer came back, no, I do not want to do this because it means I would have to take on Ruth and I'm not prepared to do it. So he didn't do it, and as a consequence, Boaz was free to marry her, which is exactly what happened. Okay, so again, it's like if you write any answer about the act of Geula, you have to compare it to the act of Yibum, something that we do know about, which is where two brothers, one is married, one is not, and the married brother dies. So the wife, the widow who is left, is obligated to marry the other brother to keep the name alive, the family name, unless they perform an act known as chalitza, a ceremonial act, to break the relationship. Chalitza becomes like giving a divorce. And then after that, the widow can marry whoever she wants. So that's what we are aware of today. That still survives in one form or another, mainly chalitza. But once upon a time, there was something called geula. And that is the whole focus of chapter 4 of the book of Ruth. Any questions? Okay, we'll make it clear. Geula, not practiced today, but similar to yibum, which is found in the Torah. The final thing, why do we read it on the book of Shavuot? Why was it written at all? So that's what we've been discussing all the way through. Book of Shavuot, the connections, very simple. Somebody help me out here. What was the connection between the book of Ruth and Shavuot? Just mention, what does it teach us about which character, specifically apart from Ruth? It is about the, who's the end of the book of Ruth? The Yichus goes right down to David. And who was born or who died on Shavuot? Surprise, surprise, David. Correct. And of course, that's one major reason why we read it on Shavuot, because it is all about David HaMelech. Even though Ruth is the main character and Boaz, but at the end of the day, it does establish the yichus of King David.
Wait, he was born and he died?
I think he was born and died. Yeah, there's a thing about tzaddikim that they seem to be born and die on the same day, Moshe. And there are a number of Hasidic gentlemen, rebbes, etc., seem to have, I think the Baal Shem Tov or something like that, seems to have the same tradition. Okay, something very, how should we say, kind of spooky about that, but don't get too spooked. Also, I want to add that the reason why I read it on Shavuot, again, Rabbi Rabinowitz, whose commentary was really something very unique. He wanted to suggest also that from the book of Ruth, we learn about Torah Shebal Peh, right? The importance of the oral law. Without the oral law, we would never know that Ruth could become Jewish. Without the oral law, we would never know so much of what goes on in terms of the whole discussion that we just now had with Geula, etc. And all of that is recorded in the book of Ruth. So, of course, the book of Ruth is read on Shavuot when we celebrate the giving of the Torah, which we argue we believe was not only the written Torah, but was also the oral law, Torah Shebal Peh. And the third reason, if you're looking for another reason why read on Shavuot, and there are other reasons as well, but one of the famous ones is because of the Chesed. The Torah, it says the world runs on three things, Torah, Avodah, Gemilut Chasadim. So we have Torah on Shavuot, the reading of the Torah, giving of the Torah, which we believe took place in Shavuot. There is Avodah, we talk about the various acts of worship that took place on Shavuot in the davening. We talk about the Musaf, etc., the additional sacrifices. And finally, Gemilut Chasadim, which is the Book of Ruth. So the whole Yontif of Shavuot reflects one of the principles that we have from Pirkei Avot. So Pirkei Avot, I think it's Mishnah chapter 1, Mishnah 2, or Mishnah 3, I think it's Mishnah 2, which says the world stands on three things, and those three things are reflected in the Shavuot holiday. And why was it written at all? To establish, as we said, many, many criteria about Shmuel wanted to be very exact about the events of the Book of Ruth for personal things in his day, and also for the future, to establish the Yichus, please God, of the Mashiach. Okay, which is really important. Yes, Brenda, please. Yeah, it's sort of like the Korbanot. There's a special sacrifice which is mentioned in Musa, which is only done on Shavuot, right? It's called the Lechem. Can't remember now. There's a whole phrase for it. If you look in the Musaf of Shavuot, it actually refers to it there. It's only done Shavuot, right? And no other time. It's an interesting thing. It's usually a korban of fine flour, a whole bunch of various things which are not brought at any other time. That's basically it. Okay, so again, look through your material, look through your notes. I'm looking at the time, I'm pretty horrified. So let's try and get through the Yonah stuff. Who was Yonah? Connection to Elio. Somebody help me out here. We've mentioned this many, many times. Yeah. He was revived. Again, resuscitate is a nice word, but not exactly what happened. He literally died. All right, I mentioned to you, Art Scroll translate Mechaye Ameitim as resuscitate the dead. That throws up a horrible image of many EMT people running around the cemetery when Tichiyat Ameitim takes place. Something I don't really want to think about. Not really what's going on. Resuscitation, no. Revival. They died. He died. He was the young lad in the story in Malachim Aleph, chapter 17. And as a consequence, his connection to Eliyahu was pretty major. Eliyahu was not only his role model, but essentially the person brought him back to life. So you really do owe a debt of gratitude to Eliyahu. And that is the background to understanding Yonah. Yonah was a prophet. Again, we'll say some general things. A prophet, we spoke about this just recently as well, who was struggling with the concept of God's behavior in the world. Right? He saw everything like Eliyahu as black and white. Midat Hadin. These are words that are really important in any answer that you give on the book of Yonah. Yonah was struggling with the world being run not Midat Hadin, with the attribute of judgment. Everything is rewarded immediately and punished immediately. But the world is run Midat HaRachamim. Right? Hashem, Hashem, Kerachim V'chanam. The attributes of God. So Yonah was struggling to the point where if he had gone to Nineveh on the request of God the first time round, he felt this was wrong because Nineveh deserved to be destroyed. Surely they're such bad people. How can we forgive them? How can we do anything to help Nineveh? And Yonah's immediate reaction was, I am not going to be part of this. I'm running away. So you could argue he's running away from God, or he's running away from the task that God is expecting of him. As a Novi, he is someone who is very significant. Alright? And of course, the question number 9, which we add, why can one ever run away from God? Why did he run away? He was not prepared to do something which initially goes against, I suggest, his philosophy, which he learned from his Rebbe, from Eliyahu. Eliyahu was a man who taught him that the world can be seen black and white. And of course, Eliyahu suffers for this as well. Eliyahu eventually understands, through Jewish history and beyond, that there has to be Erech HaPaim, that God is slow to anger. If God got angry every time people did something wrong, And there was a reaction from heaven. Not many of us will be around to tell the story. The concept of Midat HaDin, Midat HaRachamim, is basic to the whole story of Yonah, to Yonah's struggle, his personal struggle, understanding the ways of God. He also, I just want to point out, did not want to be recognized as a false prophet. And there is a Midrashic suggestion, if you look at your notes from the beginning of the book, that there was a story from the book of Malachim where he was accused of saying a false prophecy. And one of the issues of the book of Yonah, we saw from Professor Shinan, was not only about Teshuva, which is obviously why it's read on Yom Kippur, but also about the question of prophecy. Does a prophecy which is made coming from God have to be fulfilled, particularly if it's a prophecy of doom and gloom? Right? If the prophecy comes that Nineveh has to be destroyed, does it have to come about? And Yonah was worried that he would stand at the gates of Nineveh and say, this is going to be destroyed. And next thing you know, Nineveh does tshuva and it's not going to be destroyed. And everybody turns around and says to Yonah, you're telling lies. He will be called Navi Sheker, and that's what Yonah did not want. Right? Not understanding that, of course, for Yonah, the challenge was not to see it in terms of Midat HaDin, judgment, immediate punishment, but in terms of Midat Rachamim. Okay, so again, we've spoken about that quite a lot. Can you run away from God? Did Yonah? Why did Yonah run away? In fact, more to the point, what was his thought? Where did he get the prophecy? Which country was he? Where was he when he received the message from God? Right, we said in? Right, it was in Yaffa. Where is Yaffa? Everyone knows Yaffa is in Israel. So he got the message in Israel, and his immediate reaction was, I've got to get out of Israel. I've got to go to Chutz La'aretz. There, maybe God will not contact me because I'm outside the holiness of Eretz Israel. Right, it's an interesting thing, by the way, I didn't mention, but one of the side takeaway things from the book of Yonah is how holy every part of Israel is. Rav Kook, when he came to Eretz Israel for the first time, he became the rabbi of Tel Aviv. Well, it wasn't Tel Aviv in those days, it was Yaffa. He was the rabbi of Yaffa, and then from there he became chief rabbi of Palestine before the state of Israel was created. And again, Yaffa was considered to be a place of Kedusha. Okay, and again, it just teaches you, it's not only Jerusalem, it's not only Bnei Brak, but there are, I would say, more or less every footstep in Israel is treading on holy ground. This is a tradition which we have, and we can see this from the book of Yonah. So Yonah's reaction, he ran away. Can you ever run away from God? And the answer obviously is no. And this is something which Yonah has to learn and is teaching us. If we think we can just turn our back and ignore our obligations as Jews, it's something that the book of Yonah is telling us in a very, very direct way that this is not possible. This is not going to happen. Okay, especially the leaders. This is much more focused on leadership, but I think it's got something to say for everybody. Any questions on that? Because that's really, really important. Yonah's struggle, right? The sort of question that might come up in the exam, describe or discuss the struggle of Yonah in his service of the Lord, service of Hashem, Avodat Hashem. Okay, and that's something which I think is really important to think about, because it's something that we all struggle with. Okay, how does God function in this world? Try to understand certain things that take place which don't make sense. And Yonah could not come to terms with God potentially forgiving Nineveh. Nineveh was a town, wasn't a Jewish town, it was a town of the Assyrians. They were also pretty, eventually they become the force that destroys the northern kingdom of Israel. So Yonah could not come to terms with giving them a break. He couldn't understand why God would say, if they do tshuva, if they really repent, then they won't be destroyed in the biblical sense. And it's one of those interesting things we struggle with. You know, we had Yom HaShoah last week, Yom HaZikaron comes up this week. These are times, very, very trying, very testing times. Why so many korbanot? Why last week, again, 600 rockets, which is beyond belief? I'm not sure if that whole parasha is over yet, because the tanks are still in Gaza. On the border of Gaza, there's a whole thing going on down there. You're just dealing with an enemy which I can't come to terms with. So why we're holding back, I know why we're holding back, because it would be very, very difficult terrain to have a battle, but there has to come a point where, you know, as you say in Hebrew, die, it's enough, this is enough. Which I think this week probably pushed it very close to that point. Okay, so again, linking Yonah to the kind of struggles, the human condition, I think, is really something worthy of note. Number 10, what happens to Yonah on the boat? Very simple. What does he do when he gets on the boat? He goes down into the depths and he goes to sleep, right? His ultimate statement to the world is, Lo ichbatli, I don't care. I'm going to sleep. And in fact, he sleeps when everybody else, when the boat starts rocking and the sailor's going berserk. What's going to be? Yonah is snoozing, doesn't even feel the events going on around him. What happens in the whale? Obviously, he gets thrown off the ship. The sailor, what happens to the sailors? Interesting development. What do they do after the whole thing is over? They convert. They go to Yerushalayim, they bring sacrifices, and they convert. And of course, there's an extra dimension. Where do they go after that? They go to a certain city, happens to be the city of, what's the city of the story? Nineveh. The sailors end up in Nineveh, because one of the questions at the end of the book, why was Nineveh so quick to do tshuva? And the answer is because not either the king of Nineveh, the rabbis say, was the descendant of Pharaoh, so he understands what God can do, right? Pharaoh was clearly affected by the God of Israel. Or, another suggestion is that the malachim, that the sailors went to Nineveh. So they were saying to everybody, if this guy is coming in the name of Hashem to destroy Nineveh, you better take note, because it's going to happen. Because, you know, he's not a crank. He's not a madman. This is really true. So that's all part of the story of number 10. Number 11, the interaction with Nineveh. Okay, as soon as he gets there, even the dogs put on sackcloth. Unbelievable event. Well, obviously, the whole story of Nineveh, Tshuva, exists not only for the Jewish world, but we understand from the story of Yonah, it can apply to the non-Jewish one. And of course, one of the famous things of the book of Yonah is the issue of Yonah saying, well, if the non-Jews will do tshuva, what does that say about Am Yisrael not doing tshuva? If they do it, then we have no excuse for ourselves to be not doing tshuva. Remember, Yonah lives at a time of idolatry. Pretty bad time for the Jewish people, worshipping idols, etc., etc. So all of that in the interaction with Nineveh, again, look at your notes because we did say quite a lot about it. I apologize because we're getting to the end of the lesson. The whole issue of the gourd, right, which again, at the end of the story, this plant which grows and then in one night it disappears, the kikayon, in Hebrew called kikayon. And again, the whole thing is the message to Yonah that there is such a concept of midata rachamim. Okay, and don't, Yonah, for one second, sort of forget the mercy of God that he brought it for you. And Yonah, again, is sort of affected by this. He is sorely affected. He still doesn't want to see the world unless it is judged by Midat HaDin. And God is teaching Yonah a lesson in chesed, in kindness. We spoke about that. And in the end, the story of the final finale, as it were, of the book of Yonah is when Yonah, at the end, is told by God. Essentially, God says to Yonah that if I'm going to have mercy on the kikayon, essentially, if I'm going to send you a kikayon and I act in the way of chesed, then surely when 120,000 lives are at stake, all of them created in the image of God, God says to Yonah, why would I not save Nineveh if they have the correct response? And the end of the book, remember we said, does not give us Yonah's reply, but in the Midrash it says that Yonah prostrated himself, bowed down to God, and he says, I understand, and he may win, that the world is based not only on Midat HaDin, when it has to be judged, but also Midat HaChesed. And what we do in Shul, when we read this on Yom Kippur, is we add three psukim from the book of Micha, talking about the attributes of God. Erech Apayim, Mi El Kamocha, who is like you, O Lord. Erech Apayim, that you're slow to anger, because God conducts his business in this world in the ways of chesed, of kindness. Okay? Final comment here, why is the book read on Yom Kippur? For obvious reasons, as we said, to teach us about the matter of teshuva, and I would argue about struggles in life. Yom Kippur is a time when we get serious. We start thinking about the ways of God in this world, the way that maybe my own life is sort of going in a certain direction, and the book of Yonah will show you, you know what, it's a struggle which is not new. What you are going through is in fact something that even the great men of the Bible did go through. Someone like Yonah, he had tremendous doubts, tremendous issues, and in the end we learn from him that we accept the fact that there will be things that we will understand in the ways of God, and there will be things that we won't understand. The Midat HaChesed sometimes just baffles us. How can God be kind in these situations? But this is the way of Hashem. The way of Hashem is sometimes to understand and sometimes not to understand. And obviously on Yom Kippur, you can't get a more potent message than that to take away from Yom Kippur the message of tshuva and the way that God functions in this world. Again, does prophecy have to come about if it's a prophecy of doom? Says the book of Yonah, no. If people want to change their ways, they change their behaviors, things can change. Change is possible. That's what Yom Kippur is all about. Yom Kippur is saying to the Jewish people, think about what you've done individually as a nation and go through a process of change. It may only be short-lived, but you know what? Better than nothing. And you'll come back next year and you'll work a little bit more. And during the year, who knows, it may actually change something in your behavior. It's all very much in the theme of Yom Kippur. Any questions? Because I did that very quickly. Right? A lot of notes that I hope you will have in this particular subject. Yes, final question.
For number 11, the actual interaction with Nathan.
Yeah.
So, the
actual
religious
did Shiva? Yeah, well, again, the king and the whole thing about the Malachim, right? That this, you add the Midrashic element there. Just listen, please, very important. You add the Midrashic element to it, and it makes more sense why they would react to Yonah in such an amazing way. We haven't finished. Please sit down. We've got one more second. Okay, I know we're running over time, but I can't speak while you're standing up. You've got to sit down. Thank you. Okay. Again, please do not hesitate when you read something in your notes. If you're not sure, please don't hesitate to contact. Okay, we're talking another 2 weeks before the exam, so there is time to review. I hope this review is helpful. Again, I will try and get it onto YU Torah as soon as I can. Send out the link. Just want to say this has been a very challenging, right, semester for a lot of reasons. The group is very big. The books are very difficult. Okay, so the combination has been challenging. But I hope, I really do hope that all of you got something out of this, something major, because these are studies which should be with you for the rest of your life. What greater takeaway can you have from a semester than understanding the issues of chesed and understanding the issues of midat harachamim, the way that the world functions? It's heavy stuff. Okay, it's kind of up there with some pretty other heavy items, but it's so important. It's so precious. I always thank the classes I teach because I learn as much from you. Particularly your essays this year were really outstanding, outstanding. And they really do teach me so much. I learn probably more from you than I suspect you may learn from me. But at the same time, it's appreciated, and I have to say thank you for that. Don't forget to be on time at the exam. Any other questions, any other comments, I'm available by email. And I'll get back to you. Wish everybody a very good day. Thank you so much. Thank you.